Hear an overview of the public safety system. This is a joint meeting of the Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means, the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the House Judiciary Committee. I'm going to ask that the committee be at ease for about 3 minutes while we allow for a few more members to see on their television screens that we have begun and make their way down.
Vice chairs and members of the respective committees, for your record, my name is Marla Ray. I am the volunteer facilitator of the overview. Today is our last day with you. I know that makes you very sad, but you'll see us around the halls of the Capitol throughout the balance of the session as you hear from individual agencies in their budget presentations. Today, with the chair's permission, our game plan is suggested to be the following. We'll start first with responses to the questions that were posed by the chair and other committee members concerning services to girls and women in the systems, concerning overrepresentation of minorities. We'll wait until Senator Prozanski joins us and Bob Nickel gets freed up from another committee prior to answering the questions regarding dual diagnosis in mental health. We are prepared, Senator, to take questions that other committee members may have reserved from days one and two. We have, I think, a good representation in the audience of those that are prepared to respond to specific questions. Following that, Legislative Fiscal Office staff through Doug Wilson will then provide a brief budget overview so that you'll see some of the budget and policy issues. We will conclude our afternoon with you with a panel on what if then this with the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, the Deputy Attorney General for the State of Oregon, as well as the Governor's Policy Advisor for Public Safety. Before we do all of that, if that's okay to proceed that way, I would like to call to your attention some special acknowledgments, as hopefully you've imagined, and I think as Senator Devlin pointed out yesterday, there are a good number of players involved in the public safety system. If you flip in your books to the tab that says day number one, and the page just before that, you'll see the supporting cast of those that were responsible for putting this overview together for you. You can see on there the number of people that were involved. I would like, on behalf of the planning team, to acknowledge three individuals in particular from your own Legislative Fiscal Office staff. John Borden and Diane Myers were absolutely crucial players in preparing the slides and the notebooks for you. We also had some very substantial assistance from Susan Graby at the Oregon State Bar. So your planning committee is hoping that you will show some special thanks to those three individuals in particular, because they were very, very critical. With that, I'd like to call up Bob Jester from the Oregon Youth Authority, and Max Williams, the director of the Department of Corrections, to begin to respond to questions.
Thank you very much. And as they are coming forward, members, I would just like to say to Ms. Ray and all of those gathered, on behalf of the joint committees, we do appreciate the thoughtfulness, the creativity, the professionalism, backed up by a really strong commitment that has been in evidence over the past 2 days and now today. We're just so appreciative of all of your hard work, and thank you very much. Please go forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Max Williams. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Corrections, and Mr. Jester and I are here for just a couple of minutes. We've been instructed this afternoon to keep you on your schedule to respond to some questions that were raised during our presentation. We thought we would approach this by responding to the questions first relating to the issues of women in the incarceration system, and I'll provide some information about the Department of Corrections. Mr. Jester will do the same with respect to that subject matter on OYA. We'll then talk about minority representation in the criminal justice system, and then conclude with just a few comments about mental health. So if it's with your chairman, Madam Chair's approval, we'll proceed in that fashion.
Please proceed.
Okay.
And thank you.
The Oregon Department of Corrections houses 905 women at our Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville. We have another 29 who are currently participating in the Summit Alternative Incarceration Program located at the Shutter Creek Correctional Institution in North Bend. So our total female population within the system is currently approximately 934. Since the prisons opened in 2001, our Coffee Creek facility, it has been a tremendous advantage to the department to have the majority of our female offenders housed in a single institution where we can provide a set of specific resources that are most effective in working with and providing services to female offenders to lower their likelihood of future criminal activity. Some of the programs that are provided at Coffee Creek that may be of interest to you is an early Head Start program where children of incarcerated parents can participate in that program, and assuming that the female offenders are appropriately screened, can also have some contact with their children who are participating in that early Head Start program. There is an Even Start program dealing with issues involving family literacy. We have a substantial number of parenting initiatives and parenting classes that are provided there, and we even have a Girl Scouts Behind Bars program where we have a Girl Scout program that involves the mothers of these girls that participate, again, at that facility with their daughters on a regular basis. As I pointed out, I believe in my earlier comments, the female population is growing at a rate faster than the male population currently within the system, which has forced us in the revised forecast of October 2004 to change our plans in a way to request for an expansion of that facility by 324 beds. Even if that expansion is approved by the legislature, it will not be timely enough to deal with the growth of the female population, and we will have to have some females temporarily housed in county jail beds in order to manage that population as we anticipate the facility at Coffee Creek to be full. With that, I'll let Mr. Jester now comment on OYA.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come back and talk with you about the young women offenders that we have in OYA's custody. You may recall from my testimony on Monday, we talked about some of the social characteristics of the offenders that we have in the overall population, and I want to emphasize some of the differences between the young women that we serve and the young men. Currently, the Oregon Youth Authority has approximately 2,200 offenders in our custody, and of those, 262 are young women. Of the 262 young women, 62 of those are in our custody facilities. Approximately 50 of those reside at Hillcrest, which is a co-gender facility of 180 total population. 130 of those are young men, and 50 of those are young women. And between 12 and 14 of those are in our transition program, which is located in Corvallis. The social characteristics of young women, and I think that these statistics are startling. 93% of the young women that we work with have a history of alcohol or drug abuse. 77% have a diagnosed mental health disorder. 15% have had a past suicide attempt. And 56%, over half, are victims of sexual abuse. The program focus that we use is based on the individual risk need assessment of the young woman. We look at the responsivity, which is the match of treatment to the needs of the person. Protective factors, which are those factors that reduce the likelihood of further crime, such as a positive adult role model, and we focus on risk factors, which are those factors that are likely to increase crime, such as alcohol and drug use. We are continuing in the Youth Authority to build evidence-based community preventive front-end capacity for managing young women with gender-specific programs at work. An example of this would be the DBT, which is dialectic behavior therapy. It is one of the cognitive evidence-based treatment therapies, which is nationally recognized as being very successful, works very well in adolescents, and particularly adolescents with mental health issues. Rosemont is one example of a private provider that we contract with whose program is centered on that treatment philosophy. Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility, where I mentioned we have 50 of the young women housed, we focus that program on increasing strengths and competencies, developing life skills, education, vocational skill enhancement, developing healthy relationship skills, along with alcohol and drug, sex offender, parenting, and mental health treatment. Corvallis House, which is our young women's transition program, focuses on reentry. We emphasize relapse prevention and community work and education. Most of the young women that are housed in Corvallis House are either attending school in the community and or are holding down jobs in the community and are truly in that decompression phase before they return to their home communities at the conclusion of the period of transition.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisdom.
You have recidivism rights on Hillcrest and...
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, yes, we do. The recidivism rate for young women that are placed back in the community from Hillcrest is approximately 28% referral within the first year, which is about 5% less than the 33%, which is reflective of the population as a whole.
Representative Hansen and then Senator Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have any statistics on the number of young women that, before they get to our closed custody, have been through a residential drug treatment program?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I do not have that available with me now, but would be happy to provide that to you and the committee.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. I'm working about three different families right now, and their kids are on the border of getting into the system or finding some kind of prevention. Now, I am completely aware that we as a legislature have had to do a lot of cutting, and so it ties you guys' hands in many ways. But do you know of any program, and people I've worked with thus far have said the kids have to get into the system before they can get any help. I think it's a sad day for Oregon when we as adults and as citizens see some of our kids get into trouble and they have to commit a crime before they can get any help. Can you direct me in terms of where we can help these families?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think that's an excellent question, and I think that in every community there is a capacity to deal with young people prior to them entering the juvenile justice system. As you know, there is pass-through dollars that the Oregon Youth Authority provides to a local county juvenile department for both diversion programs as well as juvenile crime prevention for basic services. There are additional funds that pass through from the state to local jurisdictions from the Criminal Justice Commission. There are funds that pass through from the Commission on Children and Families. The Commission on Children and Families has a comprehensive local planning process which is intended to, in fact, address the early prevention and intervention strategies that are appropriate for the cohort of young people in the particular community in which they live. And I would be happy to provide you with additional information relative to Multnomah County if that would be the additional help to you.
Thanks. I'd love that.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Chair Gordley, before we leave this topic and go to the topic of overrepresentation of minorities in the system, it would be an appropriate time, I believe, for the committee to meet Pam Patton, who is the head of the Coalition. I'm going to get this wrong, Pam, so you're going to have to correct this. The Coalition for Equal Access for Girls.
Excellent. And as Ms. Patton is coming forward, again, just to remind the committee that we are having this conversation about services to women and girls in our system of justice, acknowledging that historically, traditionally, this is a population or populations that have been underserved, overlooked. And we're doing some things now to catch up, but we really need to have an understanding of what are we doing, what's working, what's our capacity, where are the gaps. And I know from Ms. Patton's long-standing work in this area that we have an expert here to tell us what we need to know, what we need to focus on as we get into our subcommittee work. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. I've written some testimony. Good afternoon. I apologize for being late. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pam Patton. I'm president of the Coalition of Advocates for Equal Access for Girls. That is a nonprofit, all-volunteer, statewide organization whose mission it is to ensure that Oregon's 1993 equal access law is implemented and that girls and young women receive access to the supports and services that they need in order to develop to their full potential. I'm here today...
Ms. Patton, before you go further, would you share with the committee the content of the 1993 Equal Access Law? What does that direct the legislature to do?
Yes, thank you. The Equal Access Law, which is ORS 417.270, states that it is in the best interest of the state of Oregon to ensure that both girls and boys receive equal access to gender-appropriate services, facilities, and treatment, and that to that end, it required that all state departments that serve children under the age of 18 look at any disparities between services to girls and boys, and then also after that, which was the 1995 report, that the departments report back how they are going to implement plans to alleviate any disparities in access, to ensure that there are no barriers to access to services, and that when access is given, that the services are gender-specific for the population being served. And we have had reports back from all three departments, and this year it also included the Department of Education, not this year, but in 2003, reports on how they were implementing plans to ensure that services were gender-specific. And I might say that the reason that I was late is I was at the annual meeting of the Coalition for Equal Access for Girls, in which Bob Jester was the speaker, and Craig Campbell talking about what OIA is doing with gender-specific services and for the young women in their program. I also presented on behalf of the Coalition award to Gary Weeks, because the Department of Human Services just signed into policy a gender-specific services for youth policy, whereby gender-specific services will be integrated into all levels of the department. And the Department of Human Services in Oregon is the first one in the nation to adopt such a policy, so we're very proud again of Oregon.
Thank you for providing that, for framing it and giving us the context.
Thank you.
Please go forward.
I'm here today to share with you information about the disproportionate impact of the 2003 and 2005 cuts to the Oregon Youth Authority, and to give you some information about the potential long-term impact of continuing that direction in your 05-07 budget. I do have lots of information about services that work, but I think first of all, before we talk about what works for young women, we need to look at what is in Oregon. It was assumed last session when we were doing budget cuts that because 89% of the youth in closed custody and 85% in Hawaii Community Services were males, that the significant cuts would impact males more than females. But that was not accurate. The reality is it affected both males and females, but it severely impacted girls because these continuous cuts resulted in decreased numbers of young women in OIA closed custody facilities and an increased number of OIA young women in communities who were sent back to communities frequently unprepared. I think that they were called more accelerated reentry into community programs without any additional community funding to manage those young women when they came back. Additionally, juvenile justice, which is front-end services, which is the juvenile departments, they've experienced cuts both from the state and the counties also. That's resulted in some counties, and particularly in our rural counties, eliminating many of the supports and services that we spent years trying to get for girls and young women. The coalition predicted for the legislature in OIA that if 250 beds were cut in the regional facilities, that we would see a backlash that would affect young women. As we feared, it's played out to be true that the number of young women in close custody decreased based on the cap being decreased to the counties. Before the closure of the facilities, there were 143 young women in Hillcrest and the Corvallis House Transition Program for Young Women. Today, there are anywhere from 53 to 63 young women. They were 11% of the population. Now they are 7% of the population. I want to state really clearly and up front that the coalition's position in response to this significant decrease is not that we want you to lock up more girls in order for them to get access to service. Just as I think the very astute question that Senator Carter asked is, we don't want to say to girls, you need to commit more serious crimes if we're going to give you services. What we are saying is that young women in juvenile justice deserve a system that gives them equal access to an adequate and appropriate continuum of services and treatment, from OIA closed custody to prevention services. And then we believe that the least restrictive community-based program is always the best if we can provide that for girls, but we need to provide it when they need it and not wait until there is no program around that can hold the girl long enough to give her treatment.
Ms. Patton, if either at this point or later in your testimony, if you could give us an example of a least restrictive community-based option, what that looks like and where it currently exists.
Well, in the community, there are programs all the way from juvenile departments that would provide groups for young women. For instance, Clackamas County pulled together a lot of different funding sources, including Clackamas Community College, to put together a program for their girls where they could be involved with getting college credit at the same time that they were getting some treatment. And that program was being very successful. It was a great opportunity for girls. It was a community-based program, but the funding disappeared, so it's no longer an option for girls. But any community-based program, even residential program, so all the way from support programs in alternative schools or school programs to residential, is a community-based program. So it's anything less than being institutionalized in the regional facilities. I should point out that Bob Jester has given a seat to the coalition on the OIA advisory committee, and as a sitting on that advisory committee, Bob had asked me to chair an OIA Young Women's Work Group. It's an ad hoc committee that is currently meeting right now to look at the issue of the young women that are being sent back to the communities, and those also young women who are not being referred to the facilities. So we're in the process of looking at that, and hopefully we'll, in the next month or 6 weeks, have some report that we can share with you about what the status is of the young women who were in OYA and those that are currently in there, and those are that are in the community, so that we can make some recommendations to the OYA advisory committee about that. Many girls that are in the juvenile justice service, they come from all kinds of economic and cultural statuses, and they're faced with serious issues like being abused, running away from home, dropping out of school, abusing drugs, entering prostitution, developing eating disorders, getting pregnant early, attempting suicide, and committing crimes. But young women's risky behaviors like this are less visible and less threatening to the public safety, and because of that, our systems frequently are not available to our young women until they're very seriously involved in crimes before they end up getting to services, or even very seriously involved in a mental and emotional disturbance before they end up in the child welfare system. I want to share some statistics with you, and the reason I want to do that is that I think it's important for you to realize that statistics are really the face of the young women out there that you see every day. They're your neighbors. They're the people in your community. They're your constituents, and they're young women who are have some serious issues that they're facing. And so I want to go over some of those so you can see the connection between these issues and needs that they have and the juvenile justice system. 1 out of 3 girls will experience sexual or physical abuse in her childhood. 2/3 of teen moms have histories of being abused, and 60% of our runaway and homeless youth are females, are adolescent females. 70% of girls on the street run away to flee violence in their homes, and many of these girls are at risk of entering prostitution. Nationally, the average age for entry into prostitution is 13. And if you look at females that are in the adult system in corrections, you will find that many of them have been involved also in prostitution and in running away in their youth. Nationally, the majority of prostitutes are influenced by their early experience of sexual abuse and juvenile prostitution, and it's closely linked to running away. We have a huge gap in Oregon about serving runaway and homeless youth. We do not have a department that is specifically responsible for those youth. Therefore, they frequently fall between the cracks. And when you put together the abuse that 1 out of 3 girls are going to experience and the fact that they run away to avoid that, they enter prostitution, and they and you can see that we have a serious problem where girls are not being taken care of in Oregon. Approximately 73% of girls who enter the juvenile correction system report being victims of physical and sexual abuse. I know that Bob just reported to us that in Oregon it's 56%, but this study was done in looking deeper into data about young women in juvenile justice, because many times when we collect the data, it's not at the time when you will actually get a young woman to say she has been abused. Or, and to be quite honest with you, sometimes young women don't label what's happened to them as abuse. They don't understand that that's an abuse situation. They think maybe they either deserved it or that that the person who abused them loved them, and that changed how they identify with it. Girls who have been sexually and physically abused are nearly twice as likely to be involved in delinquent acts and illicit drug activity. And 75% of suicide attempts by youth in Oregon are made by girls. Girls are 50% more likely to suffer from depression than boys. If you put all of these statistics together, you can see that the issues that young women face, that the realities of their life are very difficult, but they're not necessarily the realities that bring them into the criminal justice system for until they commit a crime, until they've used drug and alcohol to the point where in order to support that abuse they've committed a crime, or in relationship to a boyfriend when they've committed a crime in relationship to a drug and alcohol abuse. The majority of crimes that young women commit in OIA are property crimes. And so what we're looking at is young women who have not been responded to by our service system, who are involved in criminal behaviors, but the criminal behaviors are not risky enough to public safety for them to warrant the response of the Oregon Youth Authority. This is a vicious circle that we have created, and we need to seriously look at it and decide what we're going to do about it. Despite the fact that boys account for more than girls as far as overall crime, girls both in Oregon and nationally have been closing the gap of arrest and involvement in juvenile justice. Violent crime by adolescent females continues to rise in Oregon and nationally. We actually did a study in Oregon over a 10-year period, and boys decreased in violent crimes and young women increased 129%. That doesn't mean that more girls are committing, necessarily that there's a huge number of girls committing violent crimes, because you have to remember that girls average about 10% of the juvenile justice system at that level, but it does mean that they are responding more violently than they have in the past due to the situations that they live in. Our juvenile justice system doesn't seem to be designed to meet the needs of these female offenders. Our public safety and human services system basically ignore, by not providing any access to services, to these behaviors and issues and problems that young women face when they are showing signs from their abuse, from their using drug and alcohols to self-medicate their abuse, from their running away, from their dropping out of school. There are multiple reasons and issues behind that, but our system isn't designed to respond to those problems, and therefore what happens is that we get more women, young women, involved in that cycle of upping their criminal activity before we provide them with services. If we look at the fact that we're decreasing the number of girls that we're referring to Oregon Youth Authority because of the cap, what we're going to find is that as these young women start increasing their crimes because we're not taking care of them earlier, we're going to have a lot of young women where we don't know what to do with, and they won't have access to any, well, not any, but to a lot of services, and we're hopefully we're not going to wait till they get to be over 18 and go somehow into the adult correction system. We don't want our young women to end up on the streets prostituting to stay alive, to commit crimes to get their drugs, or to lose hope in the future. It's a costly future of lost potential, of lost lives, of a vicious, sad circle of our children without mothers, without fathers, who are destined to these same pathways of destruction unless we recognize and commit to actively change in Oregon our response to girls and who are our future mothers. We understand that you are in a difficult situation with your funding. We know that you face very challenging decisions. But it is our responsibility as the coalition to let you know that when you make your decisions about funding and about the services that you design, that what that effect is on the lives of the young women in Oregon. It's good public policy, and it makes good economic sense to prevent the need for more costly services by appropriately and effectively responding to the needs of these young women when they need it. I've worked with our state to develop gender-specific services guidelines for effective programming with girls, It's gotten national recognition. The Federal Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention funded the development of that. I've done national presentations. We have four other states in the nation who use Oregon's guidelines as the foundation of their services for girls in juvenile justice. We know how to serve girls. We know what to do to turn them around. The problem is that we have not chosen to do anything about it. We wait way too long to serve our girls, and we do not provide them the kinds of services that work effectively with them. We have the answers. What we need is the guidance from you all to be able to develop those systems, to be able to serve them, keep them as productive and contributing women for Oregon.
Thank you for the testimony. Excellent testimony.
Thank you.
Questions or comments? Mr. Jester, Mr. Williams. I'm sorry. Chair Krieger.
Madam
please.
Chair, these numbers, I circled, underlined them in red just before Senator Burdick came in because they're so shocking in my mind. And some of those studies are fairly old. Would it be fair to say with the last 5 years increase of meth that some of these numbers might even be worse today?
Absolutely, Representative Krieger. It is, meth is, is one of those problems that equally affects females as males, and it is a very it is a problem that will exacerbate all of the statistics that I just said to you. And the reason that a lot of those statistics are old is that a lot of the research on girls and young women is very limited, and they don't redo studies a lot on girls, so that's the reason that the data is maybe not so current. But yes, I couldn't agree with you more.
Thank you.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you agree that poverty is the biggest threat to a child's well-being, basically?
Poverty is considered one of the risk factors, but it's not a predictor. You have to have multiple risk factors in order to say that you're going to predict that a young person would end up in juvenile justice or being abused. So poverty is definitely a contributing factor, but it is not the only one or the major one.
Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess probably the OYA. 2 years ago when I was down here, we took a tour of McLaren, and they had a great high school there, and I talked to some of the kids that were going there who had never done well in school, but this is the first time they've been rested and sober and safe. And I just wondered, is there any comparable thing for the girls, for the young women?
Madam Chair, Representative Barker, absolutely. At Hillcrest, we have the Robert S. Farrell School, which is run by Willamette ASD, which is the same provider as the Education and Vocational Training Program at McLaren. And similarly, Hillcrest has vocational programs. Some are very gender-specific for young women, and some are equal. Have both young men and young women participating in them.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Our last question, Representative Hansen, and then we'll shift to your information on the overrepresentation of minorities in the system.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll throw this out as a question. Maybe you'd we can talk later about it. I don't need to provoke a two-hour discussion. But if we look at the virtual, almost a syndrome of problems that cause a young woman to get into the system, sexual abuse, drug abuse, running away to avoid, wouldn't the same thing, isn't that almost non-gender in terms of, couldn't a young man be exposed to a similar set of precursors that would cause them to, have some very, very serious problems, but probably not, but unless they became violent, they probably wouldn't be recognized by the system either?
this.
I guess what I'm saying is, it a gender? Is it totally a gender problem, or a problem that we're not providing services to very important risks, behavior of kids that aren't really violent and don't get to our don't get to the same level of attention as the violent offenders?
Right, and yes, the answer is yes to your question that. Young men are abused, young men run away, young men use alcohol and drugs to, mask their depression. However, their response to those issues is they respond differently to than girls do. And young women are in a, because of the way our society prescribes what it is to be a boy and what it is to be a girl, young women are in a different situation in responding than boys are. And yes, boys suffer from those issues happening to them, but they respond in different ways than girls do.
Thank you. Please take us to the next subject area.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next subject that you asked us to come in and comment on is dealing with issues involving minority overrepresentation in the criminal justice system. This is a recognized national problem, as I'm sure many of you are aware. I recently was reading some material that suggested that there are more African-American males incarcerated throughout the United States than are actually attending college or in university. It's a troubling problem and one that we are continuing to face in Oregon. As you're aware, the Department of Corrections is obligated to incarcerate those who have been remanded to our custody and sentenced by a court order. Our current inmate demographics in the Oregon Department of Corrections are that we have about 78% of our population is white. We have 10% of our population that is African American. We have 9% of our population that's Hispanic. About 2% of our population is Native American, and 1% of our population is Asian or Pacific Islander. We're working under our Oregon accountability model to use the various means available to us to reduce the risk of future criminal behavior. Key to that are the individual assessments that are done to identify the likely criminal risk factors for each individual inmate and to develop a plan to help the inmate overcome those risks. You heard Mr. Jester comment about issues involving identifying those risk factors and then trying to apply the appropriate level of programming. Cultural and racial differences are considered when making decisions about the programs and treatments that will prove the most effective in helping return these folks back to their community after their release with a lowered recidivism likelihood. We focus on issues involving cultural competency, and it is something that we're striving to accomplish both better as a department and also with our program providers and contractors who provide many of those kinds of services within the department. In July 2003 to 2004, we tracked over that year admissions and releases, and the good news is that we noticed some small decline in the percentages of overrepresentation in that time frame. With the African American population during that period of time, we admitted 432 new inmates into the system. We had released 442 inmates during that same period of time. Those numbers generally are reflected through the other minority populations within the system. Despite the recent trends, there is no question that African Americans are substantially overrepresented in the Oregon system, making between 2 to 3% of our state population and approximately 10% of our inmate population. Mr. Jester.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, minority overrepresentation in the juvenile justice system is, as reflected in our adult counterpart, a national problem for juvenile justice entities. There are over 200 individual decision points in the juvenile justice system. These are primary decision points when a youth can either go further into the system or stay where they are or retreat from that system. And research has shown that there is bias at every one of those. In the Oregon Youth Authority, we have 855 offenders currently in custody. Of those, 70% are Caucasian as compared to 78% of the risk cohort in the community. 10%, the same as DOC, African-American incarcerated in the juvenile justice system as compared to 3% of the at-risk cohort in the community. Native American is 4% as compared to 2% in the community. And Asian is 2% as compared to 4% in the community. And that is the one other than Caucasian that is an underrepresented population. And there is belief and research that indicates that part of that is a community norm around not trusting law enforcement officials and not looking to law enforcement as a solution to issues. And therefore, there's an underreporting that is in that community. As I believe members of this committee are aware, both Governor Kitzhaber and Governor Kulongowski have made a priority of disproportionate overrepresentation in the justice system, and both have worked diligently to bring partners to the table to discuss this issue and map out a strategy for the future. Our last summit of partners involving over 500 statewide participants from the adult and juvenile justice systems, state and local, private nonprofits, faith community, law enforcement, as well as judiciary, was held this fall. And the key strategies, first and foremost, is education of people to this issue. People need to understand the issue in order to begin to have any kind of impact on it. And that has been a major accomplishment of these summits. The second is training. There is always a need for continued training of people working in these systems around culturally specific and culturally neutral responses to behaviors on the part of offenders. The latest summit focused on the sustainable strategies to address overrepresentation, and the outcomes were impact and analysis at the key decision points in Oregon's justice system, focusing on evidence-based and best practices and using data to drive that focus and utilizing multiple strategies. What we know in the justice area as the most effective work is accomplished through partnerships and collaborations. And in this regard, we certainly look to our community partners, providers, and particularly the faith community to have an impact on this in a sustainable way in Oregon. Be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I have a request. As you referenced the most recent summit, the Governor's Summit on Overrepresentation of Minorities in the Juvenile Justice System, I would request that the findings and recommendations or the report of that summit be provided to the full committees, and that the report come with a cover letter. Mr. Campbell, if you can take a note of this, a cover letter from the Governor encouraging our members to read the report and stating the significance of the report and that work. In fact, provide the report to every member of the legislature, if you would work with the Governor's office to make sure that happens.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to help facilitate that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And thank you both. Are there questions or... Senator
Whitsitt. Yes. Senator Gordley, just in a nutshell, could you just give us a two-sentence description of what you think the driving factors, in just plain English, of why the minorities are overrepresented in these institutions? Just a quick, and I mean, yes, you don't want to.
Oh. Senator Gordley, Representative Wisnett, absolutely. I think that one is the absence of community capacity. There is not enough community capacity to address, as Ms. Patton pointed out, with services to young women. There are a special set of requirements that need to be in providers that are successful in dealing with this population prior to entrance in the justice system. And the other, I think, is a fear factor. That there is a fear oftentimes of minorities in our communities.
Thank you. Mr. Jester, you also said in your testimony that there are 200 decision points in the juvenile justice system, and that at every decision point, that there is bias at every decision point. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes, Madam Chair, you did.
I was actually, if I could, Madam Chair and Senator Wisnant, just touch on that point. There's no question, I think, the research would show, and it's very much, I think, an institutional bias that's built into the system. I think it's difficult to identify individual bias in a case-by-case basis, but when you look at the data as a whole, it is difficult to suggest that there isn't, at these decision points where two individuals who have been charged with the very same crime, in the very same set of fact circumstances, with the very same set of surrounding information, one being African American, one being white, gets a higher proportion of non-custody sort of treatment as that process moves forward, while the African American is sentenced more severely. The data simply reflects that that is in fact occurring throughout the country, and I think that's why you have had so much effort being placed behind trying to deal with these issues of racial bias in the justice system. And you get a chance here in a few minutes to hear from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and I think our Supreme Court and the efforts that the courts have led over the recent years to address those issues has been tremendously effective on raising both the importance of this issue and making progress towards trying to resolve it as a system. But it is something that all of us in every phase of the public safety system own, and it bears us spending time talking about those points.
Senator Whitsitt, you've asked a very key and very important question, and thank you for bringing it forward in the way that you did. We will have the opportunity to unpack this issue in our public safety subcommittee. And I know that Senator Starr has a question, and then I believe, Ms. Ray, you're ready to shift?
Yes, I was going to offer Senator Gordley this observation. Over the last 20 years, I've gotten used to being called Martha Ray. As Senator Devlin referred to me yesterday, it is my hope that either we do a better job at this end of the witness table, or that the senator from Klamath County and the representative from Central Oregon are close enough friends that neither take it personally.
Good. Cat Franco, this is Senator Whitsitt.
It's frankly unfair of both of you, I think, to have names so close together, but we'll let it go.
Senator Starr.
Comment more than a question. I feel like that we have failed as a society to measure up as far as our responsibility to provide the supports necessary to help the minority children to excel or to meet grade level learning opportunities in our public schools. And I know that our system shows that those who are incarcerated have the deficiency in education and reading, and as we address the No Child Left Behind idea of our national education model, I think we're going to help improve the opportunities for the minority students to meet and excel in our society.
Thank you
very much.
Senator Gordley, members of the committee, we'd like, with your permission at this point, to dispatch with the budget overview and go straight into the Chief Justice, as well as the other luminaries on our panel. This, in your notebooks, is the if-then exercise. We will begin with the Governor's Public Safety Advisor, Craig Campbell, informing you of if you make these particular decisions in the juvenile system, the effect is this in the other systems. That will be followed by Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard explaining likewise in the adult system, and then the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court with his observations on that as well.
Please, go forward. And welcome. welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And I wanted to take this opportunity to thank you again. I'm sure you've been thanked before, but it's a very rare opportunity to have a conglomeration of so many very different interests in the legislative body together in one place to hear the same message. And I just want to applaud you for allowing that to happen. I'm going to talk to you briefly about what can result as a result of reduced funding in the juvenile justice system, some of which is going to be an effect lower down, and some of it is going to be an effect further on up into the adult criminal justice system. Fortunately or unfortunately, we've actually been able to see a real-life example of the way the juvenile justice responds to an inadequate either allocation of resources or provision of resources, as occurred back in the early 1990s when there was an artificial cap at the state level for secure custody beds. What effectively that did is it increased the number of youth who, when they came into the system, would be revolved back out of the system as another youth who created a more and more violent offense came into that system. Those who then went back to the community were placed in programs that, quite frankly, were not designed to serve them. They were designed to serve less violent offenders, and in turn it operated very much like a hydraulic effect, each pushing the next level further down, so that essentially the system was unable to provide adequate services for anyone who was within that system. When that occurs, and some of the adjustments we made to create the existing juvenile justice system, is it meant that those who were coming into the system would have to wait longer before the system would adequately respond, which sent a subconscious message, essentially, that the system is not going to respond to your criminal activity. And in fact, that system did not respond until after they had committed further offenses. What that did is it created a track record for those individual youths, so by the time the system did respond, they had already gone quite a bit further than we would have liked to before we had an opportunity to address their problems, their needs, their sanctions, and so forth, in the hope that we could prevent them from going further into that system. Another element of that is that whenever you have accelerated reentry from the juvenile justice system, especially where your treatment regimen requires essentially a beginning, middle, and an end, if you leave them before that end is reached, then essentially you've spent money on a treatment regimen that doesn't work because they've never completed it. So it's important to keep a system that has a progressive level of sanction and opportunity for reform so that you can essentially divert those who can be diverted as early as possible. The sooner that you deal with a young person who's getting involved in criminal activity, the more likely you're going to allow them to reflect an optimum level of development for a positive life in the future. Now, I'd also would be remiss if I don't talk about the importance of prevention in the juvenile justice system, because that's just what happens once they've committed some level of crime. The best hope is that you prevent them from ever committing a crime in the first place, and that means getting to them before those risk factors have really developed to the point where they're a problem in that young person's life. You have an awful lot of opportunities to deal with prevention. But unfortunately, because prevention is not something that's looked at as dealing with an emergency situation, it's often a lot easier to say, well, we can't put our money there right now. We really need to deal with those most critical youth that are in the system. Unfortunately, that means that we're just effectively building up a greater and greater population coming into the high-risk population that the juvenile justice system has to respond to. Of course, by not addressing youth early enough, and by not addressing criminal activity early enough, then you're increasing a burden on the juvenile justice system and the criminal justice system as a whole, because you have more crime. You have more crime, you have more victims, and the costs that are associated with that. One other element that has become, I know all of you are aware more recently, that's going to have an impact, of course, is the area of methamphetamine. And here's an area where prevention is going to have a fairly critical impact in the juvenile justice system, because onset of initial use of methamphetamine has gotten to the age of 8 to 12. That's prior to the time that the juvenile justice system addresses juvenile crime. So it's really a prevention issue. But I can tell you that those who are engaged in methamphetamine at that age group are going to be a serious problem for the juvenile justice system now and into the future, and very likely to the adult criminal justice system. And, of course, there's that broader impact that's going to occur for the courts, law enforcement, and then the supporting treatment elements that are provided from human services, et cetera. I know that was a very quick shot at you, but I also know that you have a lot of other things you need to address today. So unless you have any other questions about the if you don't provide adequate resources to this area, what will happen, I think at that point in time I'll stop and let my colleagues pick up where I've left off.
I'm Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. Attorney General Hardy Myers chairs one of the National Association of Attorneys General committees and is attending a meeting of that committee in Chicago this week, else he would be here, and he asked me to extend his regards to the committee.
Thank you.
It falls to me to address a few of the if you do X, then Y follows in the context of the adult criminal system. Many examples of these linkages are laid out in the materials that you have in your notebook on pages 15.1 to 15.4. There are two overlapping sets of those materials, and I don't propose to try to address all of those, of course, this afternoon. Rather, I'll pick just a couple to illustrate some of the linkages that I've observed and that have been, I'm sure, discussed in the earlier sessions of this committee. The first of those if-then constructs is if resources are reduced for the adult public safety system, including funding for the judicial infrastructure, then what are the consequences? And really, there you can organize those in at least three kinds of categories. First, there are compromises in public safety, there are cost shifts, and there is an erosion of public trust and confidence in the criminal justice system. The compromise in public safety, I'll just use one of the consequences to illustrate that, and that is the fact that when the resources are reduced in the adult public safety system, one of the consequences is a de facto decriminalization or an implicit immunity from prosecution for lower level offenses, as every element of the system responds to the reduction in resources with some form of triage decision making in those matters. Now, some of these are pretty obvious, and indeed you could argue are straightforward because they're conducted in a publicly accountable way. The district attorney's decisions about what cases might be prosecuted and what cases might not, those are triage decisions in which one case is left behind and another case is brought forward. But it has the advantage, at least, of being something that's done in a public way by a publicly accountable official. But what isn't immediately obvious about the triage decisions is that the district attorney doesn't make all of those decisions. In fact, other parts of the system respond with more hidden triage decisions that are not so publicly accountable. So, for example, the victims of crime stop reporting crimes when they realize that it's futile to report that their car's been clouded or their window's been broken or that they've experienced an act of vandalism. Individual police officers, and then more formally their departments, may engage in a form of triage, recognizing that the actions that they take will not have a consequence down the line in the criminal justice system. I remember a police officer with whom I worked for years when I was a prosecutor in Marion County, who was a drug prosecutor, and he brought me a case involving a third-time offender, and because of the circumstances then existing in Marion County, we didn't have any jail space. And so he said, well, do you think we can put this guy on double, triple secret probation this time? And it was a reflection of his frustration with the inability of the system to respond in a meaningful way. That's what I would characterize as a hidden triage decision. A second kind of consequence from these kinds of choices is a shift in cost. And some of those cost shifts are pretty easy to see, but some of them aren't quite so obvious. Let me give you one example. If you make decisions that have the result of requiring the courts to process fewer criminal cases, one of the consequences of that is that the revenues that are generated for the criminal fines and assessment account will decline. And then those various programs, which are dependent, under the current structure at least, on those revenues, will in turn experience consequences. And in the case, in one of those, important beneficiaries of that fund are victims of crime, who are the beneficiaries of crime victim assistance funds that are, and programs that are managed through that resource. Third consequence of reductions in the adult public safety system, erosion of public trust and confidence. There are many ways in which this occurs, and indeed the triage decisions that I've described are perhaps equally illustrative of this, but let me just give you one, and that is the loss of constitutional and statutory rights. Both of the applicable constitutions, the Oregon Constitution and the United States Constitution, guarantee to a defendant charged with a crime the right to a speedy trial. Now, of course, it's clear to see that the individual defendant has an interest in maintaining and being able to assert that right in a judicial system that has capacity to provide that right. But less obviously, there's a very compelling public safety reason as well. And that is simply that because this is a constitutionally guaranteed right, at some point it is possible for the delay in the processing of that defendant's case to result in the release of that person. And that's a person who's going to live with us in the community and who has not been held accountable for the offense that he or she may well have committed but could not be adjudicated. Those are some of the direct consequences of overall reductions in the adult public safety system. Let me focus for just a moment, because your materials do so, on the question of what if resources are reduced for prosecution and defense functions in that system. Then what are the potential consequences? And again, I think there are two potential consequences, and they're interlinked. The first of these is that, for the reasons I'll explain in relation to the second consequence, the one effect of reducing, for example, funding for the criminal defense function is that that may cause backlogs to develop in the processing of cases in the criminal justice system. And when that happens, and when the justice system is required to triage its own cases, and it finds itself confronting the choice between handling a civil matter and a criminal matter, the criminal matter is likely to get priority in that court's docket. And as a consequence, the individuals whose interests are at risk in that civil matter have to put that dispute on hold until the court system can free up the resources. But I want to end with just what I would characterize as a epiphany that my fellow prosecutors and others involved in the public safety system, I think, experienced over the last several years. My dictionary defines epiphany as a intuitive grasp of reality through something usually simple and striking. I think that aptly describes the forcible realization amongst many of my colleagues that the reduction in resources for a criminal defense function has a direct and significant public safety negative outcome. And that is simply because, as I've said, an indigent person is entitled not only to a speedy trial, but to court-appointed counsel in order to defend that individual's rights in the face of a serious criminal charge. And the simple and striking truth that prosecutors realized over the past several years is that reducing funding for that function actually shuts down our capacity to hold people accountable criminally in this system. And so I'll just leave you then with that as a final illustration of the if-then consequences that I know are very hard to choose between, but nonetheless are the choices you're going to have to make this session.
Thank you. Chair Representative Richardson.
One question, that is, have you looked at other models that would allow the goal to be accomplished at less expense?
Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, I think that there's great merit in trying to test out those models. For example, I know that one concept that has been discussed in the past is in relation to state post-conviction relief cases. Current Oregon statutory law provides for court-appointed counsel at public expense in those matters. And it may be possible, there are constitutional limitations in some of these areas as well, it may be possible constitutionally to reduce the to reduce or eliminate the number of cases for which the public pays in that set of cases. The challenge is, I think, for public policymakers is to look very carefully at the cost shift issue. So let's take that as an example. I'm on safe ground, at least it's been my experience, in suggesting that almost every prosecutor and every state's lawyer that I know would prefer to be in court with a well-represented defendant or a well-represented litigant than to be in court with a pro se litigant. And I think that it's safe to suggest that cases in which both parties are well represented are likely to be more efficiently handled in a given proceeding than one in which one party is represented by counsel and the other is not. And so just to take that piece of it then, Representative Richardson, one would have, in assessing that policy option as a potential alternative, one would have to try and look as closely as one could at what additional costs might be incurred by the judicial system in trying to deal with a case in which a party was not represented as opposed to one in which the party was. I don't presume to tell you today, you know, fully rounded answer to that question. When we've looked at it in the past, the numbers haven't really worked out to be a net savings, but those, certainly we'd be pleased to help with those kinds of assessments.
I really wasn't implying that the alternative was no representation.
Mm-hmm.
I was implying that maybe there's other ways to provide representation than the way we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I started practice 25 years ago and was on a court-appointed list, and the judge had a list, and he said, you're going to represent this person, and you're going to represent this person, and we got a call, and they said, and this is how much you're going to make.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just part of being a lawyer, that you just did that. And then things changed, and it became a contract situation where a group of defense attorneys got together, and they bid on a contract, which changed the whole way it was handled. And then from there, it's now two decades later, and the costs have grown substantially. And so I'm just wondering if there might be other ways to provide the representation other than what we're doing, because there's always this kind of this assumption that it's just going to cost more and you've got to give us more money. And everyone that comes before us says the same thing, that you've got to understand there's consequences for not fully funding this, and if you don't do it, the consequences are going to be grave. But nevertheless, we still have to make these decisions because there's less funds to meet the needs of everyone that comes before us, and we understand that this needs to be done. I'm just asking if there are other models in other states or other ways that it might be looked at that we could accomplish the goal of adequate representation at a lesser cost.
Madam Chair,
before you go forward, Mr. Ozan, would you like to come up and join us since we're talking about your area of one of your areas of expertise?
Madam Chair, I'm glad you did that. I was about to invite Mr. Ozan up, so.
Well, thank you, Chief. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Ozan. I'm Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services and the Public Defense Services Commission. Madam Chair, Representative Richardson, we have, and I've been on this job for 2 years. I've looked after 15 years in private practice and being invited to direct the operation, have been searching for the most efficient, been going around the country, actually appearing before other legislatures who are moving from a county-based system to a state-based system, and that's the first reform, I think, that needs to happen and happen here in the 80s. But how to efficiently do it? I think that there's really three models, as you say, the court-appointed process, the contracting system, and then there's the state centralized system. And there's ongoing debate, there has been for the 30 years I've been in law practice, about which are more cost-efficient. In my own judgment, looking at how we've done it in Oregon, which is essentially a hybrid between a contract, and we still have appointment lists, although it's, as you point out, much less so. But we think we get more effectiveness for the dollar by asking for competitive bids by groups of lawyers and paying them on a per-case basis, as opposed to the court appointment process, which in years past, and the way we do it now, is paid on an hourly basis. And as we all know, those of us here who are lawyers, even though it's nice to have the clock ticking, there has to be limits placed on those billable hours. And, of course, that would be my job and is in those court appointment lists. But we think by contracting with lawyers, giving them a package of cases on a per-case cost basis, we really get more efficiencies than we would by the appointment hourly-based system. Those lawyers have to make judgments among the bundle of cases they get about to pick the ones with merit and the ones with likelihood of success and focus on those and handle the others more expeditiously. So we indeed think we have a system that's more effective at this point, though we can go to places and still hear the debates, but I think we really have the best structure at this point.
Senator Whitson.
Chair Gordley, for anyone on the panel, actually, during the last 3 days, and I would compliment you, Chair Gordley, on this. This has been a very instructional, very, very worthwhile exercise the last 3 days here. For me, certainly it has. But one of the things that strikes me, your epiphany, if you will, the two large skits that we had and the testimony over the days has shown me that there's a tremendous amount of process in this situation. The sheer number of steps and agencies involved in a business atmosphere, that would lead to inertia. And I wonder if that, to some extent, happens within the system. And the question is there a way to streamline in any way that system to reduce the number of steps and still maintain the still protect the rights of the accused?
You're first, Chief.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think all the parts have been working with each other to a greater or lesser degree for some time, and we have taken a look at how we can do it faster. There is no question about that in the criminal side, particularly, there is a lot of process. Can it be shortened? Yes, and we've tried to do some of it. For instance, now we're doing a lot of our post-convictions by video rather than transporting the person from Snake River back to Marion County, and it's all done by video. That's saving us transportation dollars and a variety of other points. So we're constantly looking. I should identify myself. I'm Molly Carson, the Chief Justice, State of Oregon. We're constantly looking for ways to improve the system, and total quality management was the first, I won't say epiphany, the first time I moved into it, that you can actually reduce the number of hands that work on a given project. And I would say we have a lot of hands working in the justice system. But the stakes are very high. If you shortcut it, you're going to get to do it again, either because the Supreme Court says you didn't provide the process that the legislature provided by statute. For instance, part of the, when a person pleads out to a plea agreement, the judge is required to inform him that him or her, as you heard earlier, it's the hers are getting up there now, but inform him that if he pleads guilty to this particular crime, he can be deported, he can be denied readmission if he's an alien. And you tell everybody that, not just those who are alien, because you don't know. And you can, and then if he gets back in, he will be denied the opportunity to be naturalized. Now, you could jump over that, but if you do, you're going to get somebody up the line will void the sentence. So, long answer, not very helpful, I'm sure, but yes, we're constantly looking at the process to see where we not cut corners, but move it along, and because we are under, all of us are under a duty to do it as expeditiously as possible. One time the statute said, when took it right to the Supreme Court, said, and the legislature, this years before, and I think any of you were here, and we want the Supreme Court to do it expediently. And Justice Graber, who was on the court, put a footnote in, we think they meant expeditiously. We are poised to do it expediently if that is what you want, but I don't think that's that. May I?
Certainly.
Go ahead. I was going to add Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think also you saw yesterday a good example, and your question is a very apt one, a good example over my lifetime in the law of about 30 years with juvenile law and juvenile dependency law. Pretty much the way it worked 30 years ago was the state pretty much did what the state thought was in the best interests of the kids in society, and we all know that while government
is well-intentioned, that sometimes government steps on toes and maybe doesn't do the right thing. So about 20 years ago, lawyers and others got together and injected a due process model into that therapeutic model, and now you have the two combining and trying to strike the right balance between achieving what society wants and trying to do it fairly. And I think the juvenile system is a pretty good example of trying to find that balance. And as the chief says, sometimes we're hamstrung with too many lawyers and too many processes, but that's essentially what the law is struggling with in this area, it seems to me.
Good afternoon, Chief.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Wally Carson, Chief Justice of Oregon Supreme Court. Since 1981, the Chief Justice, by legislative change, has become the administrative head of the Judicial Department, and that's really the role I'm here, and not just the presiding judge or officer of the Supreme Court. I, too, want to thank the members of the committee, the chairs, for putting this program together. I think one of the things that is most difficult in the system is the partners in the system are not fully aware that it is indeed designed to be a system and it must work as a system, and that has been your theme through the last couple of days, and I want to emphasize that. My predecessor as Chief Justice Edwin Peterson created both on the civil side and on the criminal side an advisory committee, and referred to it, and glad Senator Winters isn't here, at CJAC, it's Criminal Justice Advisory Committee. And he started it, and then I continued it when I took over. And we've expanded it. We kind of shut it down during our budget problems in the fairly recent past. But we're now back up again. And what we do is we bring together judges and defenders from the public defender side of the House. And we bring together prosecutors. We have one in here with Bob Herman is here as a district attorney in Washington County. And we of late have invited a representative from the chief of police and a representative from the sheriff's office. And I'm sure Mr. Williams is aware that when we get issues that relate to corrections, he can be sure that he'll have a seat at the table to talk about how we can iron the things out and work it out. And we've had quite good success. We're now looking at, we have a subcommittee working on docketing concerns, because that was part of Governor Kulongoski's initial program that worked on the interim. We're having the whole group is working on funding, a balanced funding message, and as one of the key issues for all the players in the system. And so we'll be doing that kind of work, continuing on to work out through our issues so we... The last place we want to have a fight is in front of you folks. It gets really ugly. And so we will try to resolve it and come together and make a presentation to you on a variety of issues that relate to corrections or law enforcement or prosecution or defense or the court system itself. Let me point to a handout. I think Mr. Penn has previously distributed. It's just this. I let them use color this time. I'm really flinchy about using color, but I said, yeah, this is our first time. Let's go for it. So, and this is Justice in the Balance. I won't read it to you, but it does hit some points that have been a common theme, and my partners up here have presented it. The adult criminal justice system is a multifaceted web, and it's designed to be that way. Integrated, interdependent parts, delicately balanced. And then each part is indispensable to the whole. It even goes out further. For instance, one of the problems we have when we've been quite successful with working with drug courts, recidivism rate is way down when we do the drug court system. But the providers that provide the health care aspect of it, when there's a bump in the revenue stream for those who are providing it, it hits us. It has nothing to do directly with the criminal justice system. It's the Oregon Health Plan and some of the others. But a large number of the people who are going through drug court are, in fact, on the Oregon Health Plan. So that change there makes a difference. Resource, policy, or structural changes in any part will have a tendency to destabilize the system. Resource, policy, or structural changes on one entity will make a change on the other. And the three government branches share the responsibility to sustain that system, and of course we include you as well as a very important part of sustaining that system. Mr. Campbell and Mr. Shepard outlined the broad brush stuff. Fortunately or unfortunately, because what we've been through at the tail end of the 2001-2003, and I know those who were here when this, we were going through our funding problems, are deeply aware of it, and perhaps others who have only recently joined us in Salem might be aware, but the backside is a pretty good example and features some newspaper clippings resource for what happened in your area down there, Representative Richardson. What happened, we became unfunded for 4 months at the tail end of the 2001-2003 biennium. We shut down a part of the, we put everybody on furlough, all our state employees that work for the court systems went on furlough, 10%. They worked 10% less and got paid 10% less. We laid a number of people off. We didn't fill vacancies. And in the injured defense side, which was still in the Oregon court system, we stopped appointing lawyers for non-person misdemeanors. Closed down the court system at the lower end of it to try and reprioritize everything we do. We tried to keep the more significant matters up front and operating. So we've had experience of facing the cliff, and we may have that opportunity again. It's not something I'd like to repeat. The one I will point out to you is the Statesman Journal article from April 19. There was a fellow who got into auto theft, and we call it in Oregon unauthorized use. We have a very gentle way of referring to it, unauthorized use of a motor vehicle. Everybody else calls it auto theft. I don't know why we have that. Crazy. But this fellow was released from the Marion County Jail on his third arrest. No prosecution yet. I mean, he's indicted. Third arrest, and within 4 hours, he went back to the same automobile dealers, the Dorn brothers, out here on Portland Road, and stole another car. And his story is on the back page there. So there are some real-life examples of how any change in any part of the system will affect it. And I would say, that the same message would be true for child abuse and neglect of the juvenile side of the house as well. With that, again, I thank you for allowing us the opportunity to participate, and I will try diligently to respond to questions.
Chief, I would appreciate if you would talk about the work that you have led over the past 11, 12 years around access to what we call the access to justice effort.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my predecessor, Edwin Peterson, one of the first things I did when we shifted the gavel was appoint a committee to study racial and ethnic issues in the court system. And it wound up being in the justice system because it just as you've discovered here, we talked to people in corrections and law enforcement and the Oregon State Bar and the law schools. And they did a study and found, and the report was released in May of 1994, that indeed we do have bias and prejudice in the criminal justice system at a number of points. And there were some 72 recommendations on how to improve the system. When that report was put in, one of its recommendations was twofold. One was to put an implementation committee to move us forward to accomplish those 72 identified points. And I did that and appointed Paul Nunez, who was on the Court of Appeals, as the chair of that group, and then he worked on that. And also a recommendation was that we have an oversight committee, and I don't like the use of that word, but a committee that won't let it gather dust and just be forgotten and sit on a bookshelf somewhere. And so we have this Access to Justice for All committee, and the chair has been gracious enough over the years to be a very good member of that committee. And we are working with, and we have, again, a broad group of people that represent a number of interests to see that we can make the justice system in all its aspects more fair, more open, less prejudiced, less biased for all Oregonians. We have subsequently done the same study on gender in cooperation with the Oregon State Bar, and now we're working on a program for the disabled, the ADA program. And if we get done with that and I'm still hanging around, then my purpose would be to look at age differences within the justice system, the juveniles and the elderly, which are outcomes. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, you've been an outstanding leader around these efforts for well over a decade now, and I just want to again publicly commend you for all that you have brought to this work. You really, your efforts and the efforts of former Justice Peterson have placed Oregon in the forefront of working on these issues. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For the quality of your leadership. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief Justice, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I wonder if we can have a comment from you on one particular thing that I'm sure the subcommittee and is going to be dealing with, as well as DHS is going to be dealing with, Matt Smith, amphetamine abuse. One of the hopes I have for dealing with this is that the drug courts, with a combination of the stick and the carrot, could actually make an impact into our meth epidemic in this state. I'd like to hear your position on it, your views on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Bates. Meth is one of our most significant problems. It used to be in marijuana, and then it moved into meth, and we've had education programs for the judiciary on meth, and I didn't realize how serious it was. What hit home, I used to be in the Air Force, and they have a meth product now called jet meth. It's made with JP4. That's our fuel for jet aircraft. And, you know, it's toxic, but that's one of the ingredients. And so our drug court program has been, as I say, quite successful. We're going to get one, we hope, starting in Washington County soon. And it has been very good, and recidivism is way low compared to the revolving door. It's a little unrealistic because the people are picked. They don't get on the program unless the DA says, yeah, you can get on the program. And so these are people that we think, I don't know whether you've ever seen a picture of the woman over, I think, a 6 or 8 year period of time that was using meth. It'll shock you, and what actually changes physically, not only mentally. But so, yes, we're very supportive of it, and we're hopeful that, and I'm uninformed on whether there are some unique problems about meth. Meth tends to be used, as you heard, by some very young people, and whether they will be susceptible to, well, for instance, I attended a graduation that Pamela Judge Abernathy had. We have a juvenile drug court in Marion County. And these young men were on, I don't think it was meth, I think it was probably marijuana, it was their drug of choice. But they graduated and got their degree and went on to work or college or something. So, yes, it does.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I think we're at a place of making another transition. And again, thank you, Chief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roseanne. And Mr. Campbell, we know that you're available for any additional questions around the methamphetamine efforts and other issues as well. Thank you.
Chair Gordley and members of the committee, I don't know about you, in which made me more nervous, the Chief Justice getting flinchy or Pete Shepard having an epiphany. Bob Nickel, if Bob would join us now, we are prepared to respond to the inquiries yesterday concerning mental health treatment. This is your opportunity to follow up also on some of the information that Bob and his colleagues provided regarding the mental health system and its role in the public safety system.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which is in the Department of Human Services. Appreciate the opportunity to speak briefly about the issues in treating persons with co-occurring disorders of mental illness and alcohol and drug abuse. I thought I would first just lay out some of the basic data, prevalence data, if you will. About 50% of all persons with a severe psychiatric disorder, and by that I mean things like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, have a co-occurring disorder of alcohol and drug abuse or addiction. 50%. That's a fairly standard figure now, well established all over the country and certainly in Oregon as well. according to studies within this state and other places, 70% of those patients who are admitted for acute psychiatric inpatient care in our community psychiatric units, about 70% of those people are currently struggling with an alcohol and drug problem or addiction. A couple of years ago, we did a survey and found out about 5% of the 100% of admissions were methamphetamine psychoses. So, but 70% of people who come in other words, it's much more common for there to be an alcohol and drug problem complicating a psychiatric disorder if people have that level of acute psychiatric crisis. And we have about 6,000 admissions per year that are publicly funded. So that's a very large number of people. 80% or more of homeless people who have mental illnesses also have a co-occurring disorder of alcohol and drug abuse or addiction. And Linda Teplin, who's one of the national researchers on this in the Chicago area, has done the definitive studies and show that about 90% of mentally ill people who end up in the criminal justice have some kind of alcohol and drug problem. So it's a very pervasive issue. And I think whenever we talk about the issue of mentally ill people ending up in the criminal justice system and even in the juvenile justice system, we have to assume that way more often than not, in fact, almost always with adults, there's an alcohol and drug issue in the background or foreground. And just round out the picture, about 40 to 50% of people entering alcohol and drug treatment programs have a co-occurring psychiatric disorder. Now, the psychiatric disorder is not nearly all of the time or even most of the time schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. There are many other forms of depression or anxiety disorders, phobias, panic disorder, those kind of things that get included in that count of 40 to 50% of the alcohol and drug clients. So, just summarizing what I see as the main treatment issues, the first one is the adoption of evidence-based practices. We now know, after about 20 years of research, generally speaking, what's going to help most people have a co-occurring disorder. Now, any particular person has got to have their treatment plan tailored to their needs, and they need to participate. So what I'm talking about is, generally speaking, though, we know the general approaches to take. And the outlines of that are basically these: a no-reject policy. By that I mean, programs that are going to treat people who have co-occurring disorders cannot be throwing people out of treatment because of the very problem that they have. That seems like common sense, but the practice has been for many years that if you go to an alcohol and drug treatment program and you have a psychiatric problem, you've been asked to go get your psychiatric problem straightened out, and then we'll be happy to treat your A&D problem. Or vice versa, you go to a mental health program, you have an alcohol and drug issue, you might be told, hopefully not as often in this state as some other states, but you can be told, go deal with your alcohol and drug problem, then come back and we'll treat you for your psychiatric problem. I think we proved conclusively that doesn't work. So what we really need are programs that have no reject policies, they don't throw people out of treatment because they're struggling with the other set of problems. That leads to the other major concept here, which is we need simultaneous treatment, not sequential treatment. So we need to find ways to assess how alcohol and drugs interact with the person's psychiatric problem, vice versa, and design treatments that serve both sets of problems at the same time. That doesn't mean the mental health treatment provider ignores the alcohol and drug issue and pretends like it's not there. That's not what we're talking about. We have to focus on both at the same time and truly respond to both sets of issues. Following that, we need programs that provide specialized skills training and motivational counseling that take into account both sets of issues are going on at the same time. And finally, vocational and housing supports. We really cannot expect to treat people with these kind of disorders and ignore their need to work and their need to have housing and their need to get some income coming in. So I'm giving you in broad brush what many people in mental health and addiction services go to 3 and 5 and 10 day training courses on, but these are the basic outlines of the issues as I see them. We need a lot of help, I think, and a lot more work in terms of training and workforce development. Not enough mental health people are trained to recognize alcohol and drug problems. Not enough alcohol and drug providers are trained to assess and then intervene with mental health issues. We need a balanced, in my opinion, a balanced use of correctional coercion approaches with treatment approaches. I think it's clear that with people who have both sets of disorders, particularly those that run into legal problems, that you can't just ignore the legal problem and expect to work only on the treatment issues. But on the other hand, you can't just lock people up and expect these issues to magically be treated and go away. So, again, a balanced approach. Since I spent a lot of time around the country working on this issue as a consultant, one issue that frequently came up was people thought that if we just created a lot of residential programs, we could solve this problem. When you think about 6,000 acute care admissions a year and 70% of those having this kind of a problem, you're talking about maybe 4,000 residential beds. That's not going to happen. So again, I think we need to figure out ways to judiciously and wisely use whatever residential capacity we have, short of hospital care, to treat folks who have both sets of problems. And finally, I don't think there's any real solution to all of this unless we do a better job of early intervention and prevention. When 90% of high school kids have used alcohol already, and we know that a certain percentage of those kids are going to develop, say, schizophrenia in the next 5 to 10 years, you can begin to see that we've got people who are almost primed to have co-occurring disorders. Alcohol and drugs are one way of dealing with symptoms, particularly early symptoms of a mental illness. Most people would prefer, frankly, to be thought of as having an alcohol and drug problem rather than to have a psychiatric disorder. So what happens a lot of times is youth begin to use, partly as a way to medicate their issues, partly as a way of saying, well, you know, it's the alcohol, not something else that's going on. So I think we're learning more about early intervention projects. Just about every chance I get, I talk about the early assessment and supports treatment program that's been developed in this community here in Salem and the surrounding counties. They take kids who are 16 to 24 years old, having their first psychotic episode. They wrap services around the family. If they have to be hospitalized, they do that. But they try to be very careful about medications. Not that medications are bad, but we don't want to over-medicate people at that stage of the game and make them resistant to taking medications the rest of their lives. And they focus on the alcohol and drug issues that are involved. The program has been extremely successful, in my opinion, and most of these kids are now back in school or working. And I can tell you from my own personal referrals to this program, because I've had an opportunity to do that, we're kids who would otherwise be in our forensic hospital if it weren't for those kind of early intervention approaches that are being used here. These programs are more expensive initially, and that's why they don't exist in every community. But I just have to say that I don't think we'll ever get on top of these kind of problems until we find ways to have these kind of projects in our communities. So I think with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions.
Mayor Burdick, and then Senator Carter, and then Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier today, I went out to testify at the Lottery Commission, which is considering expansion into line games. And I'll admit, I went out there to testify in favor of lowering the commissions for tavern owners so that we can get more money into our budget to support problems like yours, to prevent, to treat people in an appropriate way and prevent our situation from getting worse and their situation from getting worse. But while I was waiting to testify, there was compelling testimony from a woman who lost her son to gambling addiction. And that, as I listened to you talk and know the fine work that you do in your department, it raised the question in my mind of what are we doing for gambling addiction in our society, and whether there's any relationship between the gambling treatment, minimal though it is, that we are still offering, and what you do in your department, and just hear any comments from you on how gambling addiction fits into the overall set of disorders that you are describing.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, the gambling addiction programs for the state are actually lodged in my office. So we have a person by the name of Dr. Jeff Murata, who's become actually internationally known for the work that he's doing. Oregon actually has one of the better, if not the best, gambling addiction treatment approaches in the country. We work with a variety of agencies, mostly through county mental health programs, to provide the actual service. We have a hotline, we have outpatient care, and we have some very limited residential supports available at this time. I could provide you with considerable more detail, but I think it's fair to say that we do have a successful program going in Oregon, and we're anxious to continue to try to keep up with whatever demand is out there.
Thank you. You mentioned the co-occurrence of alcohol and drug addiction with underlying psychiatric disorders. Do you find that same phenomenon with gambling addiction?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, there are many people who have co-occurring gambling issues and alcohol and drug, but it's not as great as some people might have expected. If I remember correctly, it's in the neighborhood of about 30.
If I could interrupt you, referring to the co-occurrence of gambling addiction and a psychiatric disorder, not necessarily drug and alcohol. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, it's a very high incidence of depression among people who have problem gambling issues, a very high rate of suicide, as you heard one example, and I happened to catch a little bit of the program on television this morning. I heard the mother talking about her son who'd committed suicide. So those are great risks. It's not real clear yet, though, whether there's a direct correspondence between gambling addiction and certain kinds of psychiatric disorders. It seems like there's probably, it's separate things that are going on, but often if people have other underlying psychiatric disorders, it has to be taken into account in the treatment of the gambling disorder. I think that's one reason it's good for us to, in this state, to have a close connection with gambling addiction treatment and mental health programs so that as we identify people who have either mental health problems or A&D problems, that they're able to quickly get into treatment for those co-occurring problems.
Thank you, and I'm glad to hear your assessment that we are doing a good job. I had not been under that impression, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Hanna, and then Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. You mentioned the need for treatment of dual issues, i.e. drug and alcohol, along with psychotic issues together. And I've known a number of drug and alcohol counselors, probably we all do in our own communities. Many times those folks come from the system themselves, go later to educational programs, and go back into treatment facilities to participate in that type of thing. The level of educational need or the professional training needed to be properly trained to do the kind of work you're talking about, I'm wondering, are you talking to the folks in our university systems or at Oregon Health Sciences? Are we developing a curriculum to train people to properly handle more than one mode at once? I mean, it seems like we're raising the bar here, but are we putting people in place to do that?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, that's a great question. Yes, we are beginning to work with the universities in higher education. We have one of the recommendations that came out of the Governor's Mental Health Task Force was that we needed to be better prepare our workforce for the real world that's out there. So Dr. David Pollack, who's the medical director for my office, is the lead person on that. I would say that overall in the alcohol and drug treatment arena, the number of people who have more advanced degrees has been gradually increasing over the years. So I think the idea that alcohol and drug programs are at a great disadvantage probably is something that was more true years ago and is less true now. Many, many people. For example, I started in the alcohol and drug treatment programs in Jackson County after finishing up my master's degree in social work, and that's not an unusual experience to have. In terms of are there training programs out there, yes, the state of Oregon in the mid-1980s began a series of trainings for alcohol and drug and mental health workers where we would bring half mental health workers and half alcohol and drug workers together for a three-day training on co-occurring disorder treatment. So that's been in place for a number of years. We've probably trained probably close to 1,000 workers by now out of a workforce of 6,000 to 8,000. Secondly, we've actually had an affiliation with the Dartmouth, New Hampshire Psychiatric Research Center for a couple of years now, and they're probably the leading resource research and training-wise in this. They've now created a number of training tapes that we're making available to any of the programs that want to work with them. One issue there is that those tapes are more geared toward adults with severe and persistent mental illness, and I think they're less evidence-based practice for alcohol and drug programs that are serving people with psychiatric problems, and they're not clearly geared yet, in my opinion, to youth. So we need to do some adaptation of those, but there are beginning to be some very well-crafted, standardized training materials that are available to people without necessarily sending people back to graduate school.
Senator Bates, and then I think we'll wrap this section up. Senator?
Thank you. I know we have a short time, and some of this will be handled by a subcommittee, but I'd like to have you a comment on two things, if you could, for us real quickly to make it clear. One is in treating people who have a first psychotic break, the importance of early intervention treatment to stop the progression of the disease. A lot of people aren't aware of that. And secondly, the effect of a lottery as far as addiction gambling in this state. I was here prior to the lottery and knew what happened to people who had a gambling addiction, essentially no treatment at all, versus you have a waiting list now, and do you think that gambling addiction has worsened since we've had a lottery, or has it been something that's with us all the time and now we're dealing with it?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, let me take the second question first. Dr. Murata is my expert on this, and basically what he's, how he, I think, would answer the question is to say that it's really a matter of exposure. The more people who are exposed to gambling, the more people who are going to develop problems. So as gambling generally goes up in terms of the availability of gambling opportunities, if you want to call it that, the more it's going to catch some people who may be likely to have problems. So I expect that there will be an increase in the numbers of people that are going to have gambling addiction problems, and I think that's certainly part of the risk. I think that's why the legislature was wise years ago to set aside 1% of the lottery proceeds for gambling addiction treatment, which is the funding source for our gambling addiction programs in Oregon. As far as the first question that you, your comment that you raised, the programs that are working now in this area in terms of early intervention are modeled on some programs that were developed earlier in Australia and New Zealand. Now it turns out that our program, people who've developed these programs, are being asked to go other places and explain how they're doing it in the United States. In fact, I'm aware that they even went back to New Zealand a couple of years ago to report back on what they are doing. So it's been kind of cross-fertilization, if you will, between some early adopters in Australia and New Zealand and, frankly, Oregon's project, which is really one of the leading programs in the country here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nickel. I would just say to you that those of us who've had the opportunity to work with you over a period of time, I know if Senator Carter were here, she'd join me in this, certainly Senator Winters, Senator Bates. We are just absolutely blessed to have the quality of your leadership around these issues in this state and at this time. And thank you very much for your presentation today. Ms. Ray.
That was very nice. He gets that instead of a raise. I do know that Representative Wisnett has a question on behalf of Representative Olson, so if I could have Ramona Foley join me, we'll be prepared to answer that one.
And while she's coming forward, members, I would just say, because we are going to run out of time, that the presentation materials on the budget and policy overview are in the notebook. I would particularly draw your attention to the pages that lay out the key budget issues for the 0507 session, starting on page 14-7. If we would all key in on those pages, and particularly those of us who will be going into the Public Safety Subcommittee work starting tomorrow, it would be very helpful. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Gordley. For the record, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an assistant director at the Department of Human Services with Children, Adults, and Families. And there's a question.
Madam Chair, thank you for your leadership in this, and as a sort of quasi-freshman, been very informative, and I appreciate your time and leadership in doing this for us. Do we get our diploma today, or do we have to?
We should talk about that. Go forward.
Mrs. Foley, our Representative Olson asked me to be sure and ask today, he was concerned, what is the percentage of children removed from drug houses that test positive for meth today? Is that a...
Senator, well, Chair Gordley and Representative Wesnett, I can tell you that we estimate about 40% of the children coming into foster care are coming from families where there is alcohol and substance abuse. We will have to try to find out. Our data system doesn't pick up which children have actually been exposed to meth, but we could probably do a survey and try to determine that over a short period of time as to how many cases we have where the child has actually been exposed. If that would answer your question.
Okay. I think that's what he's concerned about, is they coming from a community that has been exposed previously. And, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
we don't have to answer today because we're short, but I had also asked about the foster homes child support, so if I could get that information, I'd appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anything else for the good of the order?
Senator Gordley and committee members, we hope that we have, over the last 3 days, achieved the goal of demonstrating for you the interrelationships that are so critical to the functioning of the public safety system. And on behalf of those agencies and officers that you will be seeing now in your respective committees in House Judiciary and Senate Judiciary, in the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means and the Human Services Subcommittee on Ways and Means, we very much appreciate your attentiveness, your questions, and your interest, and we are completed with our presentation.
Members, would you join me in a round of applause for all of us?
Madam Chair.
No raise.
Mr. Burdick.
Madam Chair, I would like to personally express on behalf of this entire committee, this joint committee, my appreciation to you and all the work that you have put in on this presentation. It was very impressive, and I know there were a lot of staff, people that you worked with. It takes a lot of time, and even though I've been around the block a few times, the information was very valuable, and I appreciate it very much.
Well, as much as I appreciate hearing a compliment, I have to tell you that all of the praise belongs to the team. Marla, Doug, everybody out here. I don't want to miss anyone's name. You guys have done a phenomenal job, and again, we thank you so much for helping us gain the information that we need in order to do our best job on behalf of Oregonians. Thank you so much. And, ladies and gentlemen, we are adjourned.